Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 806 on this Thursday. It's June 25th, 58 degrees here in Old Town Park City on the phone with the ABC Forecast Center. Erica Martin, good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. So today we're going to see some isolated thunderstorms. I'd say after midday for sure. Cold front is going to dive on down. It's actually just cutting through diagonally across Utah right now. And behind that, we are seeing some isolated showers, a lot of it high base, but locally for you guys, it looks like those thunderstorms will develop again after midday. Temperatures for today in the low 80s, and then tomorrow we're going to be in the upper 70s just behind that cold front, and I'm tracking some thunderstorms for later in the day. And it would be isolated, but still we could see one or two strong ones. And then for Saturday, we're going to see a mix of sun and clouds climbing back into the mid 80s. So I'm going to go with an 84 on Saturday, overnight lows in the upper 50s. On Sunday, it looks like another cold front brings more showers, isolated thunderstorms, and an increase in wind speeds and wind gusts, a high of 78 degrees, overnight lows in the upper 40s. And then we get really cool on Monday. It's going to feel like early spring with low 60s in the forecast, and then overnight lows in the 40s. It looks like we will see some showers on Monday and lingering into Tuesday, and we could see a lingering shower into Wednesday. So it's a little unsettled for the week. It's going to be on and off and definitely a break in those clouds, but it's just going to be kind of an unsettled stretch early next week simply because there is a really strong cold front that's going to bring a lot of cold air, strong winds, and some isolated thunderstorms. But for today, we're just going to go ahead and track out those isolated thunderstorms for Park City. And again, a high in the low 80s.
Thank you, Erica. Busy morning up ahead. Stay tuned. We've got Park City Chamber Bureau CEO Bill Malone calling in with an update on the legislature special session last week and what that means for tourism marketing for the rest of the summer as well as this coming winter. Steinerville Basin Planning Commission Chair Ryan Dickey with a recap from Tuesday's marathon seven-hour meeting discussing the Colby School Bed and Breakfast application, the first public hearing on the proposed Dakota Pacific project at Kimball Junction, and then Wasatch County Council candidate Kendall Crittenden, one of two Republicans on the primary ballot, talking about why voters should send him on to November's general election. Stay tuned. Well, Park City's 4th of July parade, the Kimball Arts Festival, have been canceled for this year, but several other events still ahead for the summer and fall. The Park City Council, in its regular meeting tonight, will have a discussion about how to handle those mass gatherings. KPCW's Rick Bruff has more.
The council convenes electronically at 4:30, and at 5 o'clock we'll talk about special events. City Manager Matt Dias said they will look at tournaments for sports such as soccer or lacrosse, in addition to Miner's Day, Autumn Aloft, Shot Ski, and Halloween. Some events may be canceled and others may be held with stringent regulations. Dias said it's a challenge to balance health and safety with the local economy and jobs.
Events are a large component of that, and the kind of vertical integration of all the jobs and service industries that go into our events really runs the gamut and is significant. So we felt it was time to, you know, kind of come in and talk with council, have a public forum. The idea is to try to make an informed policy decision moving forward. We'll be bringing in stakeholders from the chamber and the lodging and the restaurant industries. We'll be bringing in the health experts from Summit County.
He said as the city council makes decisions, they are not necessarily bound by what the state decides to do.
Clearly, our elected body has the, you know, the authority to move beyond the state guidelines. You know, just because the state guidelines allow a certain threshold, we could always be more restrictive if we felt it was in our community's best interest.
Oh, we can do that. We don't need state approval?
Not necessarily. I mean, we are, and for a lot of these events, we're the event permittee. So we're the entity that's allowing the event to happen. We're either using our rights of way or we have contractual agreements with the event organizers.
Next week, the city will not be hosting the traditional Main Street 4th of July parade or the activities in City Park. Dias said they're hoping they can put on a fireworks show.
It could be a neat capstone to the weekend to, you know, have, you know, work with our partner at Park City Mountain, send fireworks up in the air, and people can be in their neighborhoods with their neighbors or with their friends or with their family and watch them from their homes or their cul-de-sacs in their street.
Dias said they're implementing what they like to call a locals 4th of July, which will not be advertised down in the Salt Lake Valley or elsewhere. In addition, they will have a car-free Main Street on both Saturday the 4th and Sunday the 5th.
It just seems sort of easier, that being a holiday weekend, instead of, you know, putting things in and taking things out, to just sort of have better continuity and flow throughout the weekend. We have sort of surveyed the business district on Main Street, and I think overwhelmingly they were supportive with the kind of consistent approach, and we've had some success. I think by and large, the initial reports from the Car-Free Sundays is they've been positive. People have been safe. We've been having lots of staff and other types of city officials out in the street handing out masks and, you know, sanitizer and additional signage.
Park City Manager Matt Dias. For KBCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
Hey, this is Ty Burrell. The eating establishment has been a proud supporter of KPCW from the beginning. We are now open with regular hours and following all health department guidelines. The eating establishment has been open since 1972 and is determined to continue to serve Park City.
The Snohomish Basin Planning Commission hosting their first public hearing for the large Dakota Pacific proposal at Kimball Junction. Heard from speakers mostly critical of the plan. A number of them urging the Snohomish commissioners to recommend a denial. They urged the project will accelerate growth in the area and said that the county can do better with a large, important piece of property at the entryway to Park City. About a dozen people spoke to the Snohomish Commission. They included two of the former county commissioners who back in 2008 gave an approval to the Boyer Company for an office park devoted to research and technical business. One of those, Bob Richer, noted that the Boyer approval preserved parcels of open space, kept 800 units from being spread across the hillside, and acquired land for the Kimball Junction Transit Center. Richard said while he's open to improvements on that legacy, the Dakota proposal with up to 1.3 million square feet of residential, office, and commercial highlights the type of uses that would accelerate growth. Richard said the development has a high bar to comply with the Snohomish Code Provision 2.3, which says that the county cannot create new density unless it receives a compelling public benefit.
You're giving up leverage and control to solve two problems, but you're not solving the problems. You're accelerating development, which may lead to additional unforeseen problems and issues. This proposal is premature. It is not ripe. A no vote leads to more negotiation, and more negotiation could lead to a more elegant solution. You need to feel the magic. What you feel is a queasy sensation in your stomach because there is no magic here.
In other comments, Kathy Mears said the plan looks attractive, but this is a project for an expanding urban area, and Snyderville is not that. She said a planned 1,100 residents in the project is not good news.
And this is being touted as a community benefit, and I have yet to encounter anyone who thinks 1,100 more units at Kimball Junction will be a community benefit, unless perhaps they don't understand the ramifications of 1,100 units that we all know people will get in their cars and drive. Then that's not going to be 1,100 people. That's going to be 2,200 people, 3,300 people. How many children in the school district? Nobody's even talking about that.
Todd Halber, the Park City School District's business administrator, said while the county cannot legally consider school impacts, the residential development in this project could generate some 500 students, enough for a new school. He said district leaders were hoping they could have been brought into the conversation earlier. Sally Elliott, another one of those who have approved the Boyer plan on the county commission, said that this spot is their last chance to get some high-end economic diversity.
As our community warms, as we lose our snow, as destination travel becomes problematic, please say no to this project. The developers have done an amazing job of interpreting our code and trying to understand what we're really looking for. But guess what? We really need to preserve this site to promote some sort of other kind of employment than we have now, because we won't be a destination ski resort forever.
Dakota Pacific did have some supporters. Gordie Hall said that Utah's growing and Dakota's plan is the kind of transit-oriented project that will reduce traffic over time. Tim Anker said they need to encourage the kind of business that will not be restricted to research and tech.
Dakota Pacific is proposing far less office space than is currently entitled in this project, but I think that losing the restrictions of research and technology would allow very legitimate businesses and companies with good paying jobs to come into the market, provide economic diversity for the citizens of our county.
The Snohomish Planning Commission did not make a decision. The public hearing has been continued to their meeting July 28th. KPCW News Time now, 8:16. Well, as we've reported, the Utah legislature met in special session last week to redo the budget that was approved just 3 months ago. One of the line items in that budget was for $24 million for tourism marketing dollars. On the phone with an update of whether that funding remained intact, I have the CEO of the Park City Chamber Bureau, Bill Malone. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Leslie.
So this tourism marketing fund is based on prior year visitation. The more people who come to the state, the more money that is funded.
Yes, it's a performance-based formula that the legislature had developed probably about a decade ago, and actually, you know, this budget was approved prior to these recent sessions, and the legislature went back in and looked at that $24 million and basically reallocated about $12 million of that for other uses, and then backfilled that $12 million with $12 million of CARES funding that the state is allocating now. So it was basically a wash in terms of the 12 out, 12 in, and still at the $24 million level, and obviously it's something that that the legislature and the governor feels that's important in terms of from an economic recovery standpoint.
Yeah, just given it's things are so unknown. I mean, would you even have used for that kind of?
Well, everything's so fluid now in terms of how kind of our emotions are on a daily basis. On this, but these are dollars that were allocated in a variety of ways, and they need to be spent by December 30th. So it really is, you know, I'm sure they're going to weigh this as it goes on and look at what, you know, some of those programs. We're one of those recipients of funding from the Utah Office of Tourism in terms of a cooperative grant program. And our funding is for a project that's in it's a spring marketing campaign at the kind of the last month of the ski season.
So what is Park City's share monetarily?
We have received in the past $275,000. On that, and that is what we've requested again.
So again, if the money's not spent, it just goes back into the general fund?
Yeah. Yes.
All right. Yeah. Well, Ski Utah reporting yesterday that last ski season, even though it was cut a month short, was the fourth best ski season ever. So what does that mean for things going forward, particularly with this fund?
Well, you know, I mean, obviously you have to kind of take a line in the sand and say, this is what we think it's going to be. And you know, you can debate that all the time as to what ski season looks like, but you have to take a point and start moving forward on that. And so we're definitely budgeting for probably in the neighborhood of a 40% decline in terms of fourth quarter, the Christmas season. Not a fun thing to look at, but we are having to put a plan together and expect that we're going to try to reach that number.
Well, tell me what you're hearing then. I mean, within the chamber board about our winter season, are we even making plans for it at this point? Because I know Deer Valley's not even selling season passes.
No, actually, all the companies are selling season passes. I meant Deer Valley exception. I meant Alterra passes. Mm-hmm. And in my conversations with the resorts, I mean, they're in the same spot. They're having to say, okay, this is what we're going to do, and they're learning from what's going on in Australia right now in terms of how those ski areas are operating. I think one of the things that's kind of amazing when I think back is that, you know, we're pretty fortunate. I mean, as much consternation as the community has had over the years, last few years in terms of large corporations buying the ski resorts, I think in many ways we're kind of in a fortunate situation right now by having these companies that are pretty well capitalized in ownership positions with the two ski resorts in our community. So I think they're looking at everything. know, from capping numbers to how do you do it, what happens on mountain, what happens inside, restrooms, food service, those types of things. So everybody's, you know, trying to analyze it. And I think, you know, obviously in our world, we think that a lot of this is going to come down to people's comfort levels and where are we by that time with comfort levels as it relates to air travel, because so much of our economy is based on people flying here in the winter.
Exactly. And talk to me a little bit about those ski areas that are operating in Chile and Australia. I mean, again, I mean, with borders, I think, still closed in some of those instances.
Yeah. I mean, I think what they're trying to do is that from these companies that have these alternative, you know, part of their product mix is international, is giving them an opportunity to see how things work. And granted, I don't think anybody's knocking it out of the park right now, but it is looking at how do you do that? And you know, how do you load chairs? How do you, you know, create social distancing in lines, things like that. So I think, you know, the resorts are learning from that process right now and seeing what they need to do in the future.
Yeah. Any idea what kind of numbers they're seeing?
No, I haven't seen any numbers in terms of where they are compared to last year.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about kind of our summer season moving forward. The Chamber had kind of put out a campaign, you know, about really just trying to draw people that could drive here.
Yeah.
What are we seeing?
You know, it's not a pretty picture. You know, I mean, when you look at our reservations that are on the books, we are, for our summer, which we consider the May to October timeframe, we're running about 10% for the summer in occupancy. What we are hearing is that obviously people are making their plans when they do come here. They're making them very sudden. They're calling, you know, a few days in advance, and some even are showing up without reservations and just going to the hotels and renting rooms at that, you know, just walking in the door. So, yeah, it's a struggle for businesses this summer. And, you know, when we look out on a daily basis, it just doesn't resonate right now that there are, you know, lots of reservations being made. What we are seeing is website traffic to our site is going up. And so we are generating interest. We're generating, you know, people looking for things to do and ideas, comparing us to other destinations. So there is that travel planning exercise that's going on. Is that we're just waiting to see if those are going to book in the future, and do they really need to book that far out in advance because they know that there's so much occupancy that's going unused.
Yeah, certainly probably the biggest part of the summer season is the business meetings and special events, weddings, things like that. So those are basically at 0% at this point.
Correct. Yeah, we pretty much have lost all of our meeting business over the course of the summer. Although we are seeing some, you know, we're still selling meeting business for next year. So that the good news is that we're very active in terms of the sales side for subsequent years. But we are seeing this summer, most of that business has gone by the wayside. And we are staying in touch with those meeting planners, getting them to push dates into later time frames when they feel comfortable. But we are seeing some meetings that are occurring, very small meetings, groups somewhere in the less than 50 that are doing, you know, the social spacing, kind of a, you know, interesting ways in which they are conducting their meetings to be very safe and secure. And meeting planners, obviously, they have their reputations on the line. And these corporations that are having meetings, they just do not want to see something happen, you know, while it's on their clock and those meetings. And that's a significant part, has grown to be a significant part of our summer business. In fact, some of the luxury hotels, it's in the neighborhood of about half their business for the summer is group business, weddings, those types of functions.
Yeah, so we've been kind of talking about lodging, but what about the restaurant and retail sectors of the business community? I mean, we had heard a couple of weeks ago that some Main Street merchants were seeing 90% of their sales from a year ago, which sounded pretty promising.
Yeah, I mean, we hear those too, those sides of it too, and obviously we really won't know until we see the sales tax numbers on retail. But we know that restaurants are especially challenging just because of the numbers that not only the numbers of customers that will walk in the door, but the number of seats that they can do. And so we know that we've seen restaurants already that are making plans and changing their situations based on the fact that their rents were basically based on how many seats they were able to do in a restaurant. And then, you know, where do you go from there when you have when you reduce your capacity by 50%? You're in a challenging situation on that. But, you know, the creativity is pretty interesting as to how restaurants are doing that and how they're trying to make people feel secure and safe. And those with outdoor dining obviously are in an enviable situation versus those that do not have outdoor dining.
Yeah, I also wanted to talk to you about letters apparently have been written to city and county council members about concerns with Park City going ahead, allowing the Triple Crown tournaments to take place. We've got, you know, potentially, you know, a 1,000 people each week from different states. You know, it just people are asking, is there seems to be so much at risk with very little gain. I mean, why are we encouraging these tournaments to go forward?
Well, you know, a lot of these are in the case of Triple Crown, this is a contractual agreement that we've developed with them. And it has been in the past, it's been a great piece of business for the community. It's you know, you don't get that too many of those that check in on a Sunday and play during the week. I think, you know, the issue of events is a tough one because every event is very different. You look at many of the events are fundraisers for nonprofits within the community. You look at there are those that are spectator events and those that are just participant events. And so I think you have to look at each one of those individually and say, can this be done? Is this an outdoor event? Are we talking about, you know, 22 people on a field? And can parents be dispersed? These an event like a Triple Crown event is not an event that attracts large number of spectators or large numbers of people involved in it. This is pretty much parents and kids outside. So, you know, those are hard choices to make. I have a lot of faith and confidence in the staff at the city and the county in terms of how they've handled mitigation in the past. We do have businesses that are struggling, and these are customers that that are desperately needed by some of these businesses. So, and not every event, you know, raises the tide on every business, but there's a variety of different types of businesses in town that definitely need some of that traffic to buy food and stay in their hotels, et cetera.
All right. And with Summit County officials saying that they may be asking the state for an exemption mandatory mask wearing, is the chamber taking a side on this? I mean, is that
no.
Something they would get behind?
I don't think it's something I did just an informal polling of some businesses that I knew. And there's a definite feeling on the part of many of them that a mandatory mask program would be welcomed from the standpoint of that it takes the onus off the business. Because right now, you know, that business has to make that call. And the business is very, you know, empowered to say, no one can come in here without a mask. And in many businesses would like to say that and are hesitant to do that just because they don't want to be the police when it comes to that situation. So there are businesses that are feeling that it would take the onus off the business. They could point to the regulation and say, you know, we're just following the regulations here. You need to have a mask on. I hear from other businesses that definitely think that it should remain in the business realm of that business making the call as to how they want to operate in that fashion. And I know everyone is encouraging it. I think the debate then comes down to people see noncompliance on that request and how do you move from there? And it's an issue that I'm following in a half a dozen other mountain resort communities as well.
Okay. Bill, I need to leave it there. Anything else you wanted to add, though?
I do. There's a lot of stuff that came out of the legislature, and please look this up with GOED. There's a $25 million impacted business grant program for nonprofits and small businesses. There's a cultural assistance grant program that just came out of the legislature for $9 million. There's PPE support for another $5 million for small businesses. So there's a variety of tools that are being rolled out from these legislative sessions to help small businesses. And lastly, I want to thank, even though we're in all of this, we still have organizations to run, all of the different nonprofits do. And in our case, we just switched over from our chair, Callum Clark, has stepped down and his term is up as chairman of the board of the Chamber Bureau. And Casey Metzger is the new chamber chairman of the board, and the chair-elect is Betsy Wallace from Sundance Film Festival. Oh. I want to say congratulations to them.
All right. Well, thanks for the update, Bill.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time this morning. Bill Malone is the CEO of the Park City Chamber Bureau. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Stay tuned. We'll be checking in with the chair of the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission, Ryan Dickey. Well, as we've reported, the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission held a marathon meeting on Tuesday night discussing two controversial development applications. On the phone with a recap, I have the chair of the Planning Commission, Ryan Dickey. Good morning, Ryan. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, good morning, Leslie. Great to be with you.
On the Colby School application, Planning Commission voted to deny the conditional use permit for the Colby bed and breakfast use. You've had about three meetings now trying to decide if the applicants could meet the requirement for an owner-occupied residence. In the end, commissioners voted no. In your view, why couldn't the Planning Commission get over the threshold?
Well, I think that the Planning Commission, I should say the majority of the Planning Commission, looked at just the way that the applicant described meeting that condition, which is having a paid manager or caretaker live on the property and perhaps have an ownership interest in the property that is conditional on an employment contract. So they're sort of an owner until they no longer work there, and now they're not an owner anymore. And we just looked at that and thought that didn't meet the intent of owner-occupant, the reason that it lives in the code, which is that we want a person who owns the property to live in the bed and breakfast and be a part of the neighborhood. And I'm hearing an echo of myself here, Leslie. Right, it's gone.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry. How could this, though, have been a bed and breakfast in the 1980s and can't be a bed and breakfast in the 2020s?
Well, when it was the snowed in, that was that use was approved under a different code, and now this is a new application that comes under the code that we have today. And so we're applying the standard from today's code, not the standard back then.
So what would need to change in their application to get what the property owner used to have?
Well, the commission didn't prescribe any specific standard of owner-occupant. We judge the application as it comes to us to determine if it meets the standard. And in this case, the commission thought it didn't. And then that really puts the burden on the applicant to come to us with an application that meets the code.
All right. Let's see. If the Colby applicants want to pursue the project, what do they do now? Appeal to the county council?
That's right. The county council is the final decision maker here. So our vote was simply to forward a negative recommendation on the applicant, and then they could appeal to the council and have another chance to get it approved.
Okay. With regard to the Dakota Pacific project, there are two or three items that the Planning Commission wants to drill down on in future meetings. When developers want to meet Provision 2.3 and offer a compelling benefit to justify a new entitlement, do they just say the magic words, affordable housing?
So far, affordable housing has been the one thing that the commission and the council have said meets the bar to add new density to the basin. Now, in this case, the applicants, the application says this is not new density. It's actually just a change in use. Today, the density on the property is primarily the 1.3 million square feet of tech-related uses, tech-related commercial. And the application is to change that density to uses that are primarily residential with a hotel and some office and sort of limited commercial and retail.
Okay, so it only has to do with a change in density as opposed to a change in use, provision 2.3.
2.3 applies to additional density.
Okay. So has Dakota Pacific made the case that they will maintain affordable units and that the units will be offered to people who live and work in Summit County?
The devil's in the details on deed restrictions, but certainly that's their intent. They know that affordable housing has been how you clear the bar to get things to get things you want, to get the change in uses and the change to the development agreement, which is a legislative act. And there's a lot. This is over 300 deed restricted affordable units in some form. And I think, yeah, the intent is there from the applicant.
Let's talk about traffic. Developers always claim that they won't generate too much traffic congestion. So how do we verify that?
Well, there is a traffic study, and traffic is, I think, the thing we'll really dig into in the next meeting. They've presented a traffic study that compares this application on build out to the tech center on build out, supports the idea that the residential would deliver less traffic intensity. The challenge for the planning commission is the 1.3 million square feet of tech center is slow growth. So today we have about 75,000 of that built out. That's just the visitor center and Skull Candy. So the end state for the tech center looks pretty far away. The end state with a change to housing probably comes much sooner. So you might have a little bit less traffic that comes a lot faster. So it's weighing a lot of those things together.
So do you really think that 1,100 new residences won't have a traffic impact?
Well, it certainly will have a traffic impact, especially when you look at today, there's not a whole lot there. So the applicant's case is look at what the traffic impact will be compared to the tech center when it eventually gets built out. But we know that a change to a lot of residential will drive that traffic sooner, and I would expect it to have a big impact on traffic in Kimball Junction. I think there's no question about it.
All right. Let's see. The Snyderville Planning Commission also heard that concerns about the project will impact schools. In fact, could require a new school with 500 students, but legally that can't be considered here, right?
That's right. We cannot consider school impacts as part of the application under state law. So unfortunately, it's something that we just don't talk about.
All right. The Snyderville Planning Commission also being asked to make a judgment call on the type of development that is desirable. Can the commission decide that Dakota's development isn't what we want?
It can. This is a legislative act, so it's versus something that's administrative. In an administrative act, the applicant meets the standards of the code and you must approve. Here, it's a judgment call, and so we have to look at the application in total, and we're able to listen to the public. At the last meeting, that was our first chance to hear public comment, and it was really great to get that. So we'll be able to weigh how the public feels about it, how we feel about it, how it interlocks with the Kimball Junction master plan that is approved, and decide if this is the right thing.
All right. And then with regard to the Silver Creek Village, what did the Planning Commission decide on that application? It was a request to increase height lot sizes on one parcel.
It was a change to the development agreement to increase the maximum lot size on a parcel, allow a larger mix of affordable, so over 50%, and a height increase from 32 to 45 feet. Altogether, the intent here is to allow the developer to build affordable housing on a parcel that is on the edge of the development, a larger building with higher density, and to try to deliver that affordable housing faster. But that runs a little bit contrary to the, or just simply contrary to the development agreement in terms of, at Silver Creek Village, we want to see density in the center, in the core of the village, and then have that density feather out to the edges. Having a high-rise building on the edge of the village doesn't comply with what you're looking for in the development agreement, or generally sort of good planning. And the other piece that is a change to the development agreement is the intent of it is the less integration, because you're concentrating affordable housing in one place. You know, what the commission was looking for and the council wanted to approve the original development agreement and how we've interpreted it since is we don't want to have a housing project where you look and you can point and you say, there's the affordable housing. We want affordability integrated throughout the project. But the trade-off there is it makes it tougher to build. So that's the challenge. Sorry, echo there. That the commission was facing.
So the answer was no then.
So we did forward a negative recommendation, but I think with a caveat where there was a general receptivity to the idea, but with the application. The applicant had demanded, which is their right under the statute, a decision within a certain time frame from the commission and the council. And the application was really in a sort of an incomplete state that probably wouldn't have made it to our agenda otherwise. And so I don't think the commission was comfortable approving it in its current state and without some further discussion about phasing and integration. So we did forward a negative recommendation to the council, but that does give the applicant some time to work through some of those issues and allow the council to consider them when it gets to that stop.
All right. Finally, at the end of this 7-hour meeting, you and your colleagues discussed how to avoid having to go through this again. I guess you could argue that you shouldn't have an agenda with three big items on it, but do we set time limits on speakers, one of whom went on, I guess, for 20 minutes?
I don't know if we had a 20-minute speaker. We had a couple people who went on. You know, personally, as chair, I don't love 7-hour meetings of any kind, and I certainly don't like a 7-hour meeting on Zoom. I mean, it does make it really tough. But my bias is always going to be towards having more public comment, really hearing what people have to say, and even with the commissioners, you know, some of us can be long-winded for sure. But I really want to stress test arguments and work through issues and do our job to come to the best decision. And you know, the more we work through these issues, you see people changing their minds and raising new issues. And as painful as it might feel at sometimes, I think that's our job.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
No, I don't think so. Thanks, Leslie.
All right. Thank you for your time. That's the chair of the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission, Ryan Dickey. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. News time now, 8:47. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. Wasatch County Council member Kendall Crittenton has been on the county council for the past 16 years. He's now seeking re-election for the Heber South seat, facing off against Elizabeth Hokanson in the Republican primary. Mailed-in ballots are due Tuesday. Hokanson will be joining us tomorrow at the same time. On the phone with us now, I have Kendall Crittenton. Thanks for joining us. Good morning.
Thank you, and thanks for this opportunity to talk to you.
Yeah. So 16 years ago, it may have been the county commission that you were on, huh?
No, it had been a county commission. At that time, it changed. Well, it had changed 2 years prior to a county council.
Ah, okay.
And the person I replaced was one of the ones when they changed from a county commission to a county council. There were four of the seats that four of the seats that had just a 2-year term the first go around, and the other three had a 4-year, and so I replaced one of the 2 years. So it was 2 years in when I took office.
So after 16 years, I mean, some are saying, isn't it time for somebody else to have a chance to make a difference?
Well, I guess, and if that's what they feel like, then I guess that's how the vote will go. After 16 years, we've got a lot of important issues facing Wasatch County. I thought hard and long about it before I decided to seek re-election, and I feel I've got the experience, understanding of what's going on, and I have time now. I've retired, and so I have more time to dedicate to it. And I just decided that I would give it one more shot.
All right. Well, for the last 16 years, point to some of the wins, if you could, during your time there on the council.
I think the county council, this time I've been on, we've had a lot of great wins. We've worked well as a council, sometimes better than others, but as always is the case, as people come on and go off, but we've got a lot of things. There's a lot of new things here in the county that we didn't have that we've been able to do. We've improved our event center complex that brings in a lot of activity that brings in revenue opportunities for our local businesses in Heber City. We fill our hotels and fill our restaurants with activities there. We've been able to improve that complex without any additional cost. It hasn't been a tax raise to be able to do that. Also, because of the donation and the agreement from Red Ledges people, we were able to acquire the our recreation center, which is probably, I don't know, I've not been around, but it'd have to be one of the best in the state, if not the best. The facilities we have, the size of it, and the things we do, we were able to pretty well do that without a tax increase. So those are a couple of things in that way. I think we've worked on a lot of development around and things are in pretty good shape in the county.
So Wasatch County, of course, one of the fastest growing counties in the country. So do we get to point to you as one of the people responsible for all of that development, new growth?
Well, I guess you'd have to look and see where the growth is. Right now, the growth is not in the county. It's in Heber City. And it's going to continue to add to that, I guess, legacy or that reputation, if that's what we want. The county has had, because of different things over the years, and there's some criticism of that. Sometimes I look at it and I'm not sure it was the greatest thing, but because of developers and different things they wanted, we've created SSDs around the county. And over the years, those SSDs had some development plans, and sometimes they had density that was granted to them. Sometimes they just had, you know, this is what we would like. But anyway, those areas were in place, and I think sometimes we perhaps granted them more density than what we wanted. Now, a lot of those, they haven't, because of the economy and other reasons, they haven't developed out, and they're still sitting there. And now many of those are annexing into Heber City. We have an MOU with Heber City that they would not grant those annexing properties any greater density than what they had under the county. Hopefully they'll honor that. There's some indications that some of those are getting greater density now. But anyway, and then on the south end of town, out along Highway 40, clear out there, there's that whole area filling up. So I don't know how much of the Heber City is part of Wasatch County, and that's right now, that's where the growth is coming.
You have written that you want to control growth in the valley. So how so?
Well, I strongly believe, and I'm not sure where, I mean, we need to control it. I'm not sure. I believe in property rights, and people have the right to do with their property within the zoning, if you believe in zoning. Sometimes I think zoning, you know, maybe should or shouldn't be there, but if you believe in zoning. And the problem and to control growth is people come in and they buy a piece of property. The current owners can no longer, maybe it's a farm or whatever it might be, and they choose to not continue with it, and they sell it to a developer. And when they sell it to a developer, it has certain density based on the zoning. And it seems like inevitably those developers come in and immediately want to change that zoning to a higher density. And my belief is that's one of the ways that we control growth. Years ago, just prior to the time I went on the council, there was a huge, it's called the Committee of 100, and they spent a great deal of time looking over a lot of different issues in our community and in Wasatch County. And one of those was zoning and setting up densities and where they wanted the future densities to be. And that's when they set up the codes or the zoning all over the county, which areas would be where and what kind of density. And I believe that we need to stick with that. That's what that property was when that person bought it. Discussing with some people the other day, a piece of property behind their house. And they knew when they built their house that it was going to be, and this is in Heber City, but they knew when they built their house that they had behind them was a zone that would have, you know, family housing just like they are. But
are you referring to that rezone of the 650 South that basically got put on to the ballot under Proposition 10?
I'm not sure which one you're referring to on the ballot. No, it's not that one. It's not.
This was the 20-acre rezone that in the central zone by one family.
Oh, okay. I know what you mean. No, I'm not referring to that. Oh. I'm not referring to that. That's a whole different issue. No, I'm referring to another piece of property that there's talk now that says the property owner's going to sell it, and the person that's buying it perhaps will build higher density apartments rather than family housing like it's zoned now. And I guess that's where I mean that I would like to control growth.
Okay.
If somebody buys a piece of property, they have no expectation that it can be rezoned to something different from what they want.
I want to talk to you quickly about the Mayflower Mountain Resort. Are you okay with the fact that at this point Mayflower is its own resort and not part of Deer Valley Resort?
Mayflower meaning the part on this side of the mountain?
Well, at one point we had always heard that it was going to be an expansion of Deer Valley Resort, and so far that hasn't materialized.
Well, you're talking about two different resorts, and they each have individual owners, and I guess each of them are working on their own destiny based on what works best for their economic plan. If there were no contracts or anything for them to unite, I guess they have the freedom to go a different direction if they want to.
Okay.
That would be my take on it.
All right. So you were never under the impression that this was going to be part of Deer Valley, and which is why it would be something.
Well, there were discussions on a lot of that. I'm not familiar with a lot of the talks and the discussions. Some, I'm aware of what you're talking about. But no, I don't think either of them had an obligation to go in a particular direction, to my understanding.
Cases of COVID-19 continue to grow in the state. The health department recently announced the third death in Wasatch County due to the disease. Do you support Wasatch County instituting a mandatory face mask at all outdoor events and inside all businesses?
You know, that's a brand new thing. It's just come out in the last couple of days. That third death you've referred to, was 2 weeks ago, so not been very recent, but it's tragic anyway. All three of them are. But that discussion of mandatory face masks is just new, and I haven't even had much time to think about it. We have a health board meeting this afternoon, which I sit on the health board as one of my county council assignments, and I'm sure that'll be one of the topics of discussion. We have encouraged, and I've posted many Facebook postings, usually get slammed by that group that thinks it's taken away their rights to request them to ask people to wear face masks. But I believe that we can help slow down the spread by wearing face masks when we're in public places like stores and other places. Now, whether to make it mandatory, when it came out right first off, our sheriff's department, you know, he basically indicated, no, we're not going to spend our time patrolling and harassing and arresting people if they're not wearing face masks. I guess we ask for cooperation from the citizens, help protect each other, help protect us all, and wear the face mask. But I haven't even given much thought on whether mandatory here. I know Salt Lake's asking for mandatory. I don't know. I haven't given that much thought. I'm sure it'll be an item discussion this afternoon in a health board meeting.
Okay. And just in the next minute that I have here, why should voters for the June 30th primary put you on November's ballot?
Well, I'm already on the ballot. why they should elect me.
Not the November ballot, not yet.
Well, I have no Democratic opponent, so whoever wins the primary will automatically be on the November ballot.
Got it.
With
Thank
no
you.
Opposition. So I think I would hope voters would vote for me this week, and there's a good majority of them hopefully already have. I feel I'm the most qualified for the position. I understand the issues. I spend an awful lot of time. I take the time to research and study and understand the issue and what's going on, and then I vote my best decision. I do listen to the voters. Sometimes they disagree. It seems like people, when you don't agree with them, they tell you that you're not listening. Doesn't mean you're not listening. It just means based on other information or other ideas or whatever, you didn't vote the way they maybe wanted you to. But on every issue, you got those that think you did it right and those that think you didn't do it right. But I think I understand the issues as the campaign's gone along, and I think it's been very, very peaceful and friendly. But my opponent has made some comments that prior, she just plain didn't understand what was going on and actually has made some misstatements. I've posted a little bit and corrected some of those things, and she responded back. But I guess the point is that I take the time to find out what's going on. I'm not sure other people do. So,
all right. I need to leave it there. I sure appreciate your time, though, this morning talking to us.
All right. Thank you.
That is Wasatch County Council candidate Kendall Crittenden, again, one of the two on the ballot for June 30th. The winner, of course, going on to serve for another 4 years. You're listening to KPCW Park City. Up to 64 degrees here. We've got some clouds, expecting a high today of about 80 degrees. This is KPCW Park City. Time for news.